You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring the Social Brand Forum. This industry-leading digital marketing event brings the best and brightest thought leaders to the heart of the heartland for 2 days of insightful keynotes and interactive discussions. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Heidi Grant Halvorsen. Heidi is a social psychologist who researches, writes, and speaks about the science of motivation. She is the author of the new book, No One Understands You and What to Do About It, as well as the national bestseller, 9 Things Successful People Do Differently. She is also Associate Director of Columbia Business School's Motivation Science Center and a frequent contributor to Fast Company, Harvard Business Review, and Business Insider. Heidi is a member of the American Psychological Association, the Association for Psychological Science, and the Society for Personality and Social Psychology, and was recently elected to the highly selective Society for Experimental Social Psychology. She received her PhD in social psychology from Columbia University. Heidi, welcome to On Brand.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Nick.
And I am saying this, we're recording here in mid-April, right around the fun of tax time. But I bring that up only because it was, I believe, almost a month ago exactly that I saw you speak at South by Southwest. And your talk there was about your latest book, No One Understands You and What to Do About It. Can you kind of give the elevator pitch on what the book's about?
Sure. I mean, overall, what the book is about is really making people aware of the difference between how we see ourselves and how other people see us, and that really that is in many ways what lies at the basis of most miscommunication. Right? That we think we're coming across a certain way and we're not. And the good news is that even though we are very much in the dark about how we come across to others, The mistakes that other people make when they perceive us, you know, when they really kind of don't get you, are very reliable. So it's not random. People don't have sort of a random opinion of you. They have an opinion of you based on that's very reliably related to what you do and what you say, to your body language, all sorts of things. So if you can learn how it is that people are tuning into those things and the conclusions they're drawing from them, then you can actually kind of take a little bit more control over how you come across to other people.
And as you know, I'm a brand guy, and this is a podcast about branding. And mm-hmm. I think I probably rushed the stage afterwards and said that I found it incredibly relevant from a brand perspective. Mm-hmm. Is everything that you just said, can you kind of take that interpersonal perspective there and drop it into the context for how we perceive brands?
Absolutely. And that's been actually one of the more, you know, interesting recent developments in this research area, is looking at how exactly the same, you know, the same things that we tune into when we look at other people totally unconsciously, the same kind of dimensions of their personality, you know, things like how warm they are, how competent they are. Brands get evaluated in exactly the same way. Brands can be threatening. Brands can come across as untrustworthy. Brands can come across in a way, or you can engage with brands in a way that you kind of only look at them in a very superficial way. All of the things that are true of how we look at each other are true of how we look at products and companies and how we think about them, because really we do, in many ways, our brains understand what a brand is in a very similar way to how we understand what a person is like. And so you can actually take the lessons and really apply them to how I feel about a particular product or a particular company.
So you talked about, you know, in the interpersonal perspective of that we're not just making these, you know, these kind of random judgments about things.
Right.
Is that the same process in terms of when we're, you know, being presented with information about a brand?
Yeah, and it's one of the very difficult things for people to who are engaged in, whether you're the person trying to come across a certain way, or you're the person in charge of a brand who's trying to create a particular kind of brand identity. It's very difficult for us, even though we're all perceivers, it's hard for us to put ourselves in the shoes of the person that's looking at us. And just so I think that's where a lot of brand identity work goes wrong, that you're sort of too close to it, and you assume that other people see what you see. And it's just like that with ourselves. We're a little too close to ourselves. And so, you know, we know, for example, I talked about this in the talk that you saw. Think about all the information, right, that you have about yourself that other people just simply don't have access to, right? So you know what you're thinking. You know what your intentions are. You know what your feelings are. Other people don't know any of those things. They can only guess, right? You know what your words are saying, but actually words don't have kind of inherent meaning. They are given meaning through interpretation. And so often people interpret them in a very different way. So you sort of know what it is you're trying to do. And the person who's creating a brand identity knows what it is that they're trying to do. But the perceiver doesn't have any of that information. So they have a much more limited set of information to go on, and then they have to try to figure it out. And so the way they figure that out is very predictable. It's just not very intuitive. So you know, this is one of the places where kind of taking the science approach really helps, because you know, it's not like I'm any better intuitively that in knowing how I'm coming across to other people, but because we've looked at, and you bring people into a study and you say, okay, let's watch what this person does, and then let's watch and see how these other people interpret it. And you start to see the patterns that are very, very reliable. And I think that's what happens with brands as well, that a lot of times you see a lot of these huge mistakes that people have made where, like, wow, that branding idea did not go well and was perceived, and it was you know, often people would think it was offensive, or they thought it was, they felt it was like very unappealing, even though the person who designed it thought this is going to come across great. So it really can help to sort of turn to the science and say, okay, my intuitions aren't helping me here. You know, what do we know about perceivers, and what they're looking for? And one of the things, and I talked about this a lot, at South By, one of the things we're really looking for is trust. And I know that's not new to anybody in the branding universe, that obviously having a trusted brand is very important. But what we know now about what creates the perception of being trustworthy, it can be really, really helpful and eye-opening. And again, a lot of that research came from understanding how we figure out whether or not people are trustworthy. So it turns out there are really two major dimensions that we're tuning into very quickly in our interactions with another person or with a product and a brand. And that is, those dimensions are warmth and competence. And I think I illustrated this with The Simpsons, because it turns out, as I said, you can illustrate any psychological principle can be illustrated with The Simpsons, so it's very helpful. You can think of these sort of as two dimensions, right, that someone comes across as warm or not, they come across as cold, or they come across as competent or incompetent, right? Warmth, you know, we tend to think of that as being sort of warm and fuzzy, but it's really more, do you seem like you have good intentions toward me, that you care about what happens to me, that I can trust you to have my back, right, to be my ally. People, when they come across as cold, you get the opposite feeling, right, that I don't know if I can trust you. I don't feel like you have good intentions toward me. And so that dimension, that warmth dimension, really is, are you a friend or a foe? And that's something we, by the way, our brains were designed to detect you know, it has a tremendous evolutionary value immediately to be able to tell, or at least to make a good guess as to whether something is a friend or a foe, is a life and death thing, or at least it was when we were, you know, hunter gatherers. So we're good at that. We do that very quickly. We do it very unconsciously, totally unconsciously. The other dimension, like I said, is competence, which is basically, you know, are you able to act on your intentions, right? Are you, do you have the skills and abilities necessary to actually do what you intend to do? So in The Simpsons, right, a high warmth, high competence person would be like Lisa Simpson, right? This is someone who's smart and who you definitely feel like she has integrity. She's going to go out of her way to be helpful to you. Right. She's sort of that's you want your brand to be like Lisa Simpson. You want to come off like a Lisa Simpson in life. But if you don't send warmth signals, then you're Mr. Burns, right? So then you're very competent, clearly, you know, but totally not trustworthy. You know, he steals candy from babies, literally. But again, what the mistake we make both in terms of our interpersonal interactions and in terms of branding is that we care a lot, we focus a lot on projecting competence. It's just very natural to us to really make sure that people think that we're capable and smart and talented, or that our brand is really going to deliver, you know, it has all these great, you know, attributes that are fantastic and amazing, but we don't think as much about conveying warmth. And competence without warmth is Mr. Burns. So warmth is something that actually it's you have to convey it, because if there's no warmth, then that's cold. It's like there's no neutral ground here. You know, if you're not warm, you're cold. So it's something that you have to actually think very deliberately about. Now, on the non-competent side, in case you're wondering, what about the other two, right? So if you're non-competent but warm, then you're Homer Simpson, right? Which is sort of like and basically about you know, people and brands that are not competent but warm, we feel pity, basically. Like, you feel like, oh, it's a shame, really, that didn't work out. Because, you know, I wanted to like him, but he's such an idiot, you know. And then if you're incompetent and cold, that's like Mo, you know. He's sort of like, to those kinds of people, you feel more like disgust or contempt. Like, you know, you're incompetent and you're kind of an awful person, or you're kind of an awful brand and we're disgusted by you. So you get like the four different types, and the goal, you know, whether you're, I people ask me about the book, you know, is it a book about making a good impression, right? Like, it's an impression management book. And I guess it is, but the way I've always preferred to think of it is that it's a book about coming across the way you intend to. And again, those lessons apply to brands as well as people, that how to get across that you are, you know, giving you the benefit of the doubt here and assuming you are trustworthy, and your brand is trustworthy, then how do you come across that way? And people really don't realize, I think one of the big mistakes we make is, again, not understanding. And warmth, by the way, is not that hard. I mean, interpersonally, it's actually quite easy to show warmth. We just don't do it. So, you know, you can do it with things like eye contact. And it's a shocker, but it's like really one of these basic things. If you look at people when they're talking to you, then they feel that's a signal of warmth. And it's actually become kind of a problem in our culture, you know, in recent years, because everybody's got like technology they're looking at all the time. And so we are making less eye contact when people are talking to us. And if you're looking at your smartphone when someone's talking to you, then you are giving a signal that you're cold. And that's a very dangerous thing. So nodding is another thing. When people are talking, you know, you do that kind of most of us do it totally unconsciously. Like, you nod a little bit at the end of a sentence when someone's talking to kind of indicate that you're listening. Turns out that's really important. People that don't nod make people very uncomfortable. I mean, not that you should nod constantly, because that's also weird. But, you know, a little bit of nod at the end of a sentence makes people feel like you're listening, you're understanding. That's a signal of warmth. Open body postures are a signal of warmth. And then, of course, things like asking questions, being interested in the person who you're talking to, expressing empathy where that's appropriate. And that's where I think, you know, brands tend to not have bodies, but they are able to ask questions, right? You are able to have a brand that people feel cares about the customer cares about the interaction, is wants to know what the customer thinks, is really actually cares about that, and then makes changes on the basis of that feedback, you know, and that there's that kind of interactivity that I think conveys a brand's warmth, I think, very, very powerfully. Like, we are a brand that cares about your experience. It's also something I talk to people a lot in sales about, because, again, I think it's a very common mistake in sales. You get on a sales call or in a sales meeting, and the first thing out of your mouth is, you know, this is how great our product is, or this is how great our service is. And it's like competence, competence, competence. And what the first thing out of your mouth needs to be is, you know, what are your concerns? What are your problems? What are you really looking for in a solution? Right? Before you even say like bupkis about your own product, you should be asking a lot of questions to indicate like, I care about you. Yes, I'm a salesman, and yes, I'm trying to sell you something, but I really do care that this is the right product for you, or that I help you in the most effective way possible. So it's that, it's like the order really matters, you know, that you show warmth first, you know, before you try to sell your competence, and then that equals trust. And I think that's something that is really important for brands. We know it is. There's actually a lot of really interesting research by Jennifer Aker, who's at Stanford, looking at, it turns out, exactly the same dimension that most brands, like 90% of the variability in how they are perceived can be explained by warmth and competence. So it's something that I think that people really need to take seriously.
Well, it's one of those things that I think, you know, when you go to conferences, you hear speakers talking about, you know, trust and how important trust is. But I think it's really hard to kind of tactically, you know, get your arms around that and you know, like you said, I forget how you said it, but kind of creating trust.
Yeah, because it isn't, you know, what happens is a lot of people say, well, it's important to, you know, what we hear when someone says, look, it's really important for you to be trustworthy. And then when people hear in that is like, oh, well, that's good, because we are, you know, next, like, and then they move on, right? And it's like, no. Like, it's not about whether or not you are, although I hope you are, right? But it's about whether or not the perceiver thinks you are. And that is, you know, we can't, there's this attitude I think people have that, in a way, that it's sort of like people should be figuring this out, you know, about my brand or about me. People should be doing the work to get it right, you know, and they're not gonna. I mean, they're just not gonna. You have to do the work for them to make sure they're getting you right. And again, it's whether it's your brand or it's you. Like, if you sit back and just get mad because your brand is being misunderstood by others, or if you sit back and get mad because you are being misunderstood by other people, it's just not going to do you a damn bit of good. You know, you have to actually do something about it. Take ownership of how you're coming across, and then know that there are things you can do. I mean, you just need to learn what the signals are. Once, and it's not intuitive, so it really, again, does help to kind of get some objective evidence on, all right, what signals reliably send what message. But it's hard for us to kind of get our heads around the idea that what seems really cool to us and really compelling isn't necessarily going to be really cool and compelling to, you know, someone who doesn't know everything that we know about the product or everything that we know about ourselves, right? So That's a hard thing. Like, people, we really want to, it's like so powerful to just really want to trust your own intuitions. It's so, it's like, you know, I just really, and we pride ourselves on that. Like, I just got really good intuitions about X, Y, and Z. And you know, it's like, okay, you can go with those intuitions and you'll be right some of the time and you'll be really wrong some of the time, you know, or you could have your intuitions and you could get some evidence and use both of those things, and wouldn't that be great? You know, and I do think it's really, because perception really isn't, it's complicated. I mean, the way our brains make sense of stuff, there's a reason why it's really hard to get this stuff right, to do a really good job of coming, you know, of making the right impression on people. But it's a really hard to brand well. And there's a reason it's hard, and it's because perception is really crazy. I mean, it's like, you know, there's a huge chunk of your brain dedicated to making sense of what we see, and it's just not intuitive the way it works, and it's not at all objective. Good God. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. And so it's really, really hard to just relying on your own instincts, make good decisions, because it's a complicated thing, brains, and that's what you're working with.
Well, and it's interesting because interpersonally, you know, I mean, people are hard enough to understand. You said they're complex things, brains, and I almost misheard that as they're complicated things, brands.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not even as tangible as this person standing across from me nodding or not nodding.
Right.
And, you know, you talked about, you know, the impression and I think in your talk, you talked a lot about primacy as well, that first impression.
Yeah.
Not to make this sound like even more of a complex uphill battle, but what role does that first impression play?
Oh, it's huge. I know. And I always feel so bad when I say this, you know, because I would love to be the first, really, truly, I would love to tell people like all, you know, everything everybody tells you about first impressions, again, whether you're a person or a brand, like I would love to be the one that's just like, don't worry about it. It's not that big a deal. No, it's totally a big deal. In fact, actually, the more you learn about how brains work, the more you realize how big a deal it is. And basically what it has to do with is, Our brains really are sense making machines, right? We kind of take a lot of information and we try to make sense of it. We create some sort of representation in our minds that makes sense of a person or a product or something. This is what this thing is, and that's happening. You know, that impression, we don't form an impression by gathering up all the evidence and then, you know, sifting through it and weighing it and making as accurate impression as we can. What happens is that impression is being made very much online, right? So as I'm interacting with you, that impression is forming. And so and then what is also true about your brain is that what it's really good at is interpreting whatever comes next in a way that makes it consistent with what came before. So this is really the thing about first impressions, this primacy effect, right? I mean, the primacy effect refers to the fact that whatever came first is disproportionately influential in your view of something, whether it's a person or a product. So that first impression is really key, because whatever comes later, even if it is the opposite, frankly, of what came before, you'll probably find a way, and again, this is all unconscious. It's not like you're really sitting there consciously thinking this, but your brain will find a way to make sense of it. So, for example, if you meet a new employee, and the day that he's there, and he really acts kind of like a jerk, and your first impression is that he's cold and kind of arrogant and nasty, and then the next day he comes in, and maybe he's had some time to think about how he didn't come off the way he wanted to, and so he brings you a cup of coffee. Now, are you really going to sit there and think, hey, maybe he's actually a great guy? No, what's probably going to happen is that you're going to say, oh, God, the jerky guy thinks he can totally, like, buy my attention by, you know, and buy me off with some coffee, but I'm on to him. He probably wants something from me, right? So we interpret that nice gesture in a way that's consistent with what we already think. And this is the real danger for brands too, that, you know, once it's not that it's impossible, by the way, like it is possible to change a first impression, but I think it's really important for people to understand that is challenging, like really challenging. And so if you can get the first impression right, you save yourself a lot of time and aggravation. If you can't get it right, or if you happen to not get it right, you can change it, but it really takes a lot, because what you need is to basically overload your brain with so much evidence that the first impression was wrong that you force it to actually change its mind. And like, yeah, but that tipping point really takes a lot. And so it ends up being, you have to work really, really hard to undo a first impression that's gone wrong. And it has to be really striking evidence too. It has to be attention getting. Otherwise people will just ignore what doesn't. I mean, it's part of the reason why stereotypes can be so, difficult to break, because people will just interpret whatever they see in a way that's consistent with the stereotype. And it takes a really, really long time for them. You would present them with enough evidence that they'll say, oh, actually I see this stereotype doesn't apply to you. You know, it's not a like happy story, but it is, I think, I'd rather people know the truth, right? That this is it's an uphill battle, and then be prepared to wage that uphill battle. It's sort of like when it's sort of like dieting. I mean, honestly, like, you can do it. It's just like, it's going to be hard. And anyone who tells you otherwise is selling you something, because, you know, it is very, very difficult to, you know, change your diet and exercise and do all the things you need to do to lose weight. Well, that's sort of like making a second impression. It's challenging. It's doable. But like, it's best to be prepared for that and to know that you're going to have to work pretty hard to change people's minds.
Well, I'm guessing, too, with the size and scope of brand interactions, and that many times you're talking to many, that it's probably makes more sense to focus on getting that first impression right. But that's something that seems easy to say, but is probably easier said than done. Are there three easy steps to getting your first impression right?
That is an excellent question. I would say that it's, if you can think very carefully about the typical dangers in the first impression and avoid those, then you've gone a long way. So a couple of things off the top of my head. One that I've already been hammering home because I just can't say enough about it is convey warmth. Convey warmth. Convey that you are a brand that cares about the customer's experience and the customer's opinion, and that you are an ally, right? I mean, that's really kind of what, you know, this brand is your friend, you know, is really the kind of the if that's at all possible, that's really what you want to do, because that's going to create trust. And again, you have a little bit of the odds stacked against you, because people do realize you are selling them something. And so immediately it's like you have this reactance in people that they feel like I'm trying to be convinced of, you know, somebody's trying to convince me of something or persuade me. That makes me immediately feel like you have your best interest at heart, not mine. So it's I think a challenge, but it's totally doable. And brands that succeed in doing this are very, very popular. You know, people have been convinced by brands like Costco and Trader Joe's that you know, these are companies that care about them, that care about their employees, that really want to give them good value and healthy food. And, you know, it's like, oh, Trader Joe's my friend, you know, it's my buddy. And there are companies that clearly have not been able to do that. I don't really feel like my supermarket down the street is my buddy, you know, in any way. But Trader Joe's, I feel like, is my buddy, you know. And so there's ways to do it in your particular industry with the kind of brand you have to convey that kind of warmth. So that's like really, really important. Be a brand that is warm. Also, the funny thing about competence, the other side of it, right? You know, everybody, obviously you want your brand to appear competent, that you can reliably deliver on the promises you make. But with people and with brands, when you shout that from the rooftops, people actually start to think maybe you're covering for something. There's actually really interesting research that shows that being a little bit more humble, and again, like, never say you're not good at something that you actually are good at, but being a little bit more modest and humble, Midwestern, if you will, Nick, for you, right? Being a little bit more Midwestern about your abilities and your competencies and your ability to deliver on your promises actually causes people to, on average, estimate that they're 30% higher than they actually are. Whereas bragging and tooting your own horn like crazy actually causes people to estimate that you're 30% less capable than you actually are. So I would say, like, yes, convey competence, but do it, you know, either whether it's you or your brand, like, do it in a way with a little bit of humility and a little bit, you know, just say, you know, say, yes, we're really good at this and we strive to be really good at this. And it's really important to us to be good at this, but not we are the greatest ever of all time. Makes people a little bit, you know, in an interview or, you know, with a product, makes people go like, yeah, I bet you're not. Like, the fact that you felt you needed to say that makes it me think that you're not. So that's the second thing to keep in mind. And then the third thing to keep in mind has to do with, and I see this a lot in, and you can see it backfire. The one that leaps to mind is the Abercrombie and Fitch example of how having an aspirational brand can really bite you in the ass, because it can very quickly. I mean, and this happened at Lululemon too, when it was like, oh, maybe fat women shouldn't wear our yoga pants kind of thing that went down. It's like, you know, you can go very quickly as a brand from being aspirational to being considered elitist and threatening. And so that's another kind of issue with people too. You know, I talked about, at South by this issue of, you know, at what point do your successes become threatening to other people? And the answer is pretty quickly. they become threatening to other people the fact that you're doing well, makes me feel bad about myself. And this is just one of these things that we wish, you know, we can all wish wasn't true about us, but it is true. And it happens again, largely unconsciously. And so you start to dislike people who are, you know, have a lot of success, especially in a domain that you want to be successful in. Because it makes you feel bad, right? We call it an ego threat. So how can you get around that? Well, first of all, you can be a little bit careful not to like be so elitist in your aspirationalness that you make people feel like that could never be me. And therefore now I hate you. Or, you know, the other way is really kind of being very, very careful to create a sense of us. Right. That it's like we are all in this together. And yes, we're showing you in our advertising these lovely people having great lives because they're using our products. But it's about all of us. Right. And really going out of the way to make the consumer feel like they're included in that us, rather than feeling like they, you know, yes, they aspire to be in that us, but that can really bite you. Because if it's like, I aspire to be in that group, but I don't know if I can be in that group, then very quickly, I don't actually want to be in that group and I don't like your brand. Right. So, I think that that's a fine line to walk, but you definitely want to walk on the side of, this is for everybody, you know, and this is for you and we want you to be a part of us and look at all the great fun we're having. And then it's like, oh, okay, I can be a part of us. That's great. Now the fact that you're showing me this fantastic life doesn't threaten me. Now it makes me feel like it could be mine as well.
I mean, this feels, first of all, hats off, because I put you on the spot and said, are there three easy steps? And I'll be damned if you didn't come up with three easy steps. But, you know, they're, you know, different to think about too. You talk about like the aspirational brands, and maybe it's just, you know, that Mad Men's returned for its final episodes, but you think of all of the kind of classic brand building techniques. And I think a lot about kind of, you know, the last examples that you're talking about, some of those aspirational, you should want to be like this. Mm-hmm. And it seems like either people are thinking different or we know more in terms of how people respond to things. And, you know, it seems like you kind of laddered up there too. It's like aspirational is a challenge.
It is. We're also in an environment where we can know more about a brand and a company. So, you know, Lululemon would have been just fine if their CEO didn't make a comment about how the problem with the fact that there was, you know, pilling in the pants, was because some women's thighs were too big, right? So they were doing a great job at being an aspirational brand. Women loved their clothes. Lots of women, all kinds of shaped women, some skinny ones and some with big thighs, were buying Lululemon pants and aspiring to that look that they were, you know, and it was great until somebody opens his mouth and says, well, maybe actually our pant implies that maybe our pants are only for thinner women. And now you've actually said the thing that sets off, you know, and then same thing with Abercrombie and Fitch. It's like when suddenly they were doing fine until people sort of realized that they would like wouldn't have certain sizes in the store because I think the CEO actually said, you know, we don't want to cater to those people. Okay, now you have a problem, right? And these days, you know, as opposed to the Mad Men era, these days we just, thanks to the internet and all the different ways we have of accessing information, we know a lot more about the CEOs of companies. There's a lot more opportunities for us to interact with a company. And so a lot more opportunities for people to derail the brand by creating that threat in with the aspiration. So now it's aspirational, but in the way like, like the cool kids in high school were. Like, yeah, you want to be like them, but you don't really appreciate them rubbing it in your nose that you're not like them. And that's the danger, I think, with trying to be an aspirational brand in this era. You have to really be so careful with your branding, and you can't have that one person who slips up and says, yeah, well, we don't carry, the size, things in that size, or we're not really interested in those kind of customers. You just cannot have that person. These days, the internet will destroy you if you have that person.
Well, I mean, that was ironically where I was going to go next in terms of questions, but it's kind of a natural segue of why it's so different, and we have more access to all of this information. You have to wonder, would the Lululemon founder have been on TV back in the day?
Even
pre-internet, you talk about as many cable channels and business programming that we have now, and then just how that those flames can get fanned. And I like what you said, that it's kind of like I copped to wearing a Spider-Man shirt during this interview prior to that. And I think of the great power comes great responsibility, and we talk so much about the internet as a brand building tool, but I think the other side of that is that there are more opportunities to derail. And I think sometimes we just charge ahead without, fully appreciating the impact that even some of these bad things can have.
Absolutely. And I think if you are, there are some kinds of strategies that in the social media era are going to be safer strategies, and strategies that are inclusive, that welcome everybody to the table. Like, so you're really, you have a branding message that is about, we care about you and we care about everybody and we want everyone to love this, and there's nobody we don't care about. That's a message that can withstand the greater scrutiny that comes with this era. I also think it also is really more important than ever to build trust, because with trust you can weather a storm. The good news about trust is that once you have it, it actually takes a lot to break it. People will, if they've come to trust a brand, you can have the occasional mishap or the occasional CEO who says the wrong thing. And people will tend to sort of say, oh, well, that's the CEO, it's not the brand. The brand is bigger than that, and I trust the brand. And so you have, the way that primacy works in the brain is that it's either good or bad, because if you make a bad impression, that's a big pain. But if you make a good impression, you can actually coast on that for a long time. And it'll take a while for people to really say, that brand has changed, or, I don't trust it the way I did before. So I think more than ever, it's important to think about how you're building trust so that you can weather the inevitable Twitter screw up that somebody does and, post something horrible on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, capitalizing on that and trying to relate it to selling tacos or something. People are going to make mistakes in marketing. And you can weather that storm if you have a trusted brand, and you can create trust if you convey warmth and inclusiveness. If you try to go another route, it's not that it's impossible, but you're in more danger. You really have to keep a tighter rein on the people who are responsible for your brand. Because you really, then it's like one small step and you've gone from aspirational to, if you don't need my type, then I don't need you. And that can be pretty toxic for a company.
Well, and that's really, as you say all of that, I think it kind of breaks down why I was, sitting up in my seat listening to all of this. And I really hope that marketers find this book, because, we talk about trust in social media, but it's this kind of nebulous thing, not unlike branding, to get your arms around how to actually go about building it. When you talk about how you can project that online through more questions and you know, being inclusive of your audience, more we, as opposed to kind of the social media branding version of that would be overdoing on the competence side and a bunch of updates about how great you are.
Exactly. Make it more about, you know, and if you are collecting data from your customers, if you are allowing them to respond and to feel like they're, you know, tell them about how their responses are mattering. Tell them about changes that have been made as a result. You know, keep that dialogue going. That really strengthens that we feeling, you know, and a lot of times the people really, you know, every brand, you know, creator wants that community, right, of people. They want the people that, like Apple has, that, you know, will line up for days at a time to get the newest thing because it's Apple. And honestly, they could sell you a box of Kleenex and people would probably line up to get it because there's that kind of brand, or at least has enjoyed that kind of status. And so there's, you know, everybody wants that, but it's like, okay, well, how do you get that? And I think Apple, much more than IBM or other PC creators, was able to convey a sense that they were really trying to make the computing experience that people wanted. Not that businesses wanted, right? Because the PC is still the dominant computer in the business universe, but that individuals want it, right? What do you want to be able to do with your computer, right? And so they really created that computer and created this tremendous loyalty. Like, this is the company that is really looking out for my experience and is creating the experience I want. And so that's how you tap into that, though, because it's sort of like, you know, what is that doing? Well, that's creating trust. That's creating loyalty. That's creating a sense of us. And it's super valuable. And if more companies took the time to do that, I think that they would be able to, again, like, weather the occasional storm that will happen. And yet they'll be able to rise above it, because at the end of the day, people want to be loyal to a brand they trust.
So we talk when we start to wrap up here, we usually ask folks to think about a brand that has made them smile. And it seems like a real natural, another natural segue in talking about warmth and brands that are able to do this. And we know that that your local grocer is not necessarily, but who is someone that a brand that's made you smile lately?
Oh, a brand that's made me smile. Well, you know, I'm a mom, so I do a lot of food shopping, and really, Trader Joe's makes me smile all the time because they have this, like, adorable flyer that they send out, the Fearless flyer, and it just got all kinds of great jokes and fun things in it. And I feel like it's a brand with a sense of humor. I'm a big fan of any brand that can make me laugh. I'm really a sucker for a good joke. So I think that. They make me as a mom smile on a regular basis. And let me think, what are their, I mean, I'm a huge Marvel nerd. So all of the kind of the teasers, that great ability that they have to sort of give you just the amount of information that you need to keep you, like, practically losing your mind about this thing that's about to come out, you know, a month from now. But, like, I, you know, and I'm excited about the movies that are coming out 3 years from now. And they just tease it. It's like giving you that whole, like, and here's, and we're not going to keep you waiting. Here's the six, you know, years of movies that are coming. And Apple's really good at that too. They'd say, like, oh, here, this is what's on the horizon, you know, and this is, and it's like, oh yeah, like, make me feel a part of that vision. And anticipation is so much better than actually getting something. I mean, it's one of the great truths of psychology. Like, anticipation is half the fun. So, like, brands that make me feel that sense of, like, oh man, I can't wait for that. That always puts a smile on my face, makes me really excited just to think about it.
On the Marvel front, it blew my mind. I think it was last fall. I can't think of another movie studio that's done something like that, probably because I don't know that anybody has their plans as together, and granted, when you have a connected universe, you have to, but they did an Apple-esque keynote.
I know.
Basically laying out the next 5 years, and it's like, this is brilliant. I mean, for all the reasons you just said, it makes you a part of that story, that vision, that anticipation.
Yeah. And why aren't more companies doing that style of keynote? Because it is so, again, it's like, it's for the, it has the perception of being for the fans, right? In fact, it's for much more than just the fans, right? Because they're trying to get, create new fans. Oh, and they're trying to, so it's, but it, they give, you know, even the, Steve Jobs' his Apple keynotes always felt like, this is for you guys. Yeah. You know, this is for you guys that my Apple people. And so you have this feeling like, oh, my, you know, he's bringing his Apple people more goodies. And you wanted to be a part of that. And Marvel, it's so brilliant. I'm always amazed that more companies who have that kind of ability, because they roll out products in that way, don't do that and say like, hey, this is for our like loyal fan base. We want you guys to know what's on the horizon. Like, it's genius. And it does, it's really warm. It makes you feel like you're a part, even though I have literally nothing to do with Marvel's movie making agenda.
Yet.
I feel like I'm a part. Yeah, exactly. But I feel like I'm a part of it. I feel I know what's going on. Like, this is so exciting to be in the know. And that's another way to create feelings of warmth and a feeling of us, is make people feel like they're in the know. So yeah, I mean, it's a great technique to use if you have the kind of brand that that makes sense for, and maybe it doesn't make sense for McDonald's. But honestly, like, if Taco Bell said, like, these are the burritos we're rolling out over the next 2 years, I think I might get excited about it, you know? So like, I think that to use creative ways to draw people in and say, hey, this is where we're going, and these are the innovations you can look for, man, is that smart. Psychologically, it's really smart.
Awesome. Well, like I said, I hope everybody should read the book, but I think especially marketers, brand builders. So where can folks go to learn more about you and the book?
They can, I have a website. It's HeidiGrantHalvorson.com. It's HalvorSon, but if you get close enough, Google will find me. It'll be fine. And so on my website, you can link to everything, the books and all of the writing I do for Fast Company and 99U and HBR is all there. And of course, as they say, the book is now available wherever books are sold, which I just love saying.
That is an awesome thing to say. Well, we will point everybody there. Heidi, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thank you so much, Nick. It's great talking to you.
And before we call it a wrap, I always like to flip the microphone around to our listeners and give a shout out to Andrea D. Smith, who liked our episode with Siegel and Gale's David Sreri last week. Said she listened to it over lunch, enjoyed it, loved the convo. We love hearing that. Thank you, Andrea. And last but not least, as indicated, you can find show notes and links for everything that we've talked about at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over to iTunes and click that star button to rate the show. And if you have a few extra seconds, write a couple sentences in and submit a review. We'd love to hear from you. Don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital Events series. You can learn more about Digital Strategy Bootcamp and the industry-leading Social Brand Forum right now. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.